We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, Soylent Green is People. I'm a bit of a new voice here in the podcast, for a new show as well. My name's Lee Hutchison, I'm a fellow podcaster, and I'm joined by a bit of an ex-cash regular, Russell Hugo. How you doing, Russell?
I'm doing great. I'm not sure a regular is a very kind term, but it's great to meet you, and thanks for letting me join you.
Yeah, I know it's an absolute pleasure for me. I think this has been a podcast in the making for quite a while, so I'm excited to finally get on board with this and to be joining him for this one. So, you know, I think with people, they might have listened to the XCast before. You know, as you say, you've been on it before. I'll class myself as a loyal listener. I'll go with that one. So it's probably best that we probably introduce ourselves to kind of the fans and listeners. And obviously, the format of this show is that there's some kind of those key questions to try and discover what kind of Millennium fans are. So I reckon we'll go through them together and we can pose those questions to each other. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
So, Russell, when did you first discover Millennium?
It wasn't until the mid-2000s. In the US, we had Netflix. And at that time, they just had DVDs and didn't do streaming. And for some reason, I was like, oh, I remember that. I remember seeing a promo for the show, and after watching the show, I realized all that stuck in my head was that scene from Sacrament where Frank Black throws the bed in the mental institution away, and then there's the symbol on the wall. That's all I remembered. I thought, you know, I'll give that show a shot, and that's when it probably around like 2004. I came to it pretty late.
Yeah, I sort of got into it. Early to an extent, and I'll kind of, you know, some people will be almost pretty frustrated thinking, oh, maybe I should be on this show instead. But I kind of got into Millennium in a sort of quite loose way, sort of in the kind of the late 90s, that we got it quite a few kind of months or years, I can't quite remember, behind America here in the UK. And it was sort of one of these programs, unlike The X-Files, which was like peak time television, you could find it quite easily. You know, I was, you know, in and around 10 years old when sort of the Millennium was kicking about on television for the first time. And my experience of discovering it for the first time was being aware that it was an X-Files spin-off, but finding it really difficult to find the chance to watch the episodes, or, you know, if I wanted to rent the video perhaps from a Blockbuster, or even purchase them with some, you know, Christmas money or whatever, they're rated 18. So I kind of, my experience of Millennium was just like fits and starts, and I'm quite excited to listen along to these podcast series and to get involved with them, because what episodes I've seen and in what order is just all over the place. You know, I consider myself someone that, you know, liked the show, but I'm looking forward to following along with this series, you know, watching an episode, listening to the podcast, and kind of taking it nicely into that kind of order. So yeah, like I can barely string what episodes I saw when together, so I'm quite excited to do this. So yeah, I've discovered it then, but my memory of it is just not the greatest.
It's a great asset to have you on the podcast, because I'm not sure there's too many Millennium fans who are like that. They're either people who have watched the series a few times in a row, and there's often that big divide between X-Files and Millennium, even though it was a spinoff show. There's a lot of X-Files fans who can't get into it, and I can understand that. So actually, it's fabulous to have somebody who experienced it on television, syndicated, and then is coming back. I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts.
Exactly, yeah, it's one of those ones. I got the box. We were due to obviously record this last week, but my box set never came in time, so I've watched obviously the first four episodes, kind of tricked my way back up, built back up my knowledge, you know, those things, oh yeah, I remember this, or those opening credits, oh, they definitely weren't as good as I perhaps remember. So it's going to be quite an exciting experience, I think, all in all this. So, you know, the next question makes it a bit more difficult for myself, but for you, Russell, what was your kind of favourite episode?
The tricky thing for me for Millennium is that while I do really, really love the show, it's very uneven. And even some of my favorite episodes are uneven. It's got peaks that are exceptional, but its consistency is tricky. And that's what makes it hard kind of choosing a favorite episode because they all have elements that are there. And there were a few runner-ups that were in there. There's, I mean, for example, one of my potential favorites would be Sacrament, but there's some subplot elements in it that just, that kind of drop it off. I similarly, Time Is Now and Goodbye to All That, but I had to go with Lamentation in the end. How about you?
It's one of these ones that, once again, it comes back to being so young and kind of watching Millennium. It's been one of those ones I can remember just like flashes of images or some cases or some of those kind of great cold openings. But in terms of like picking out an episode, it's like that's felt like it's maybe vanished a bit from my mind, you know, where something with like the X-Files where I could religiously watch it on television, I could pull them straight from there. Like, oh, this episode, that episode from that season. But it's just not kind of there yet. And I think come the end of this project, this, you know, podcast series, you know, in 2 years' time, a year's time, I'll be able to go, oh yeah, that was definitely my favorite episode, and appreciate it in that respect. And I suppose that'll kind of go the same for the season, you know, what episodes I saw, I couldn't pinpoint an exact season. It could have been the third season, the second season, you know, it makes it a bit more difficult. But for yourself, out of the three seasons, which one kind of stood out for you?
Oh, favorite season definitely is one. I prefer the balance and tone with the ambiguity being a bit more, I think, toned down. Ambiguity is very consistent, but it swings of supernatural to practical. They're not as extreme, I guess, to kind of sum it up. One thing that helps and that I really like about Millennium is how each three seasons are totally different, except for Frank Black being consistent. And it's kind of fun to have a show that way that's so bizarre and that you can almost look at it as if the changes in tone and the changes in structure of each season, it kind of represents Frank Black, the character's journey and mental state. And so it allows me to kind of get around some of the detours and things. But season one, by far, is my favorite.
And what about kind of your, who was your favorite character?
Frank Black is probably, I'm assuming, a cheat, as he's probably my favorite television character of all time. But if that is a cheat, then I'm going to go with Catherine.
And what is it about kind of Catherine and obviously Frank Black, like, you know, with the amount of television that I assume we both watch, you know, like for Frank Black to be that potentially one of your favorite characters, what is it about him that makes it your favorite character? And then what is it about Catherine where you think, yeah, she's up there with someone like Frank Black?
I hope I can do this without sounding too horribly embarrassing or pretentious. I mean, Lance Henriksen's performance of Frank Black, it's phenomenal, in my opinion. And I think there is this tone he reaches, and especially season one. When I had first watched the show, I'd never seen a show that would do something episodic like this. And again, I can understand this could, maybe people will roll their eyes a little bit. But back in the 2000s, and then watching a show where episodically is deconstructing masculinity in a critical way. But then at the center, you have somebody who is the antithesis or a positive representation of that, you know, according to U.S. Western society, but it's not played on the nose the way that they could have done this, making Frank Black very much an action hero or hyper passive, something like a traditional Sherlock Holmes. Instead, he just feels very real. He feels like a wounded person, a kind person, an intelligent person, but none of those things are too exaggerated. And I think the key is how he relates between the police work he does and his family, and how his family relates to him is unlike anything I've ever seen on television, in at how grounded it is. Yes, there is some very pointed conversation because it's 40 minutes and Catherine and he, you know, they gotta get to the meat of certain things, but the way that both the actors portray it and work with the dialogue, I've just never seen a relationship like that portrayed. And Catherine, similarly, somebody who is sort of a secondary character and is playing a spouse, but this person has an entire life, an entire world going on over there, and is very headstrong and compassionate. They're basically identical, but they're able to develop a lot of distinction on their own and then play off each other in nice ways. As a side note, if I'm boring people and I can edit this, I showed this to my friend and he ended up binging everything in about a week, and he hated the show. And one thing he hated was, like, I can't believe they're always having these talks, you know, heart-to-heart talks. I'm like, well, this is an episodic series. You're supposed to watch week to week, and you've only got 40 minutes to get all the story. And then in that, I think the story between Catherine and Frank and Jordan is something that really resonated with me, I think. They all did a great job. Long answer.
Yeah, but these are the answers, you know, if you're listening to a Millennium Fan podcast, these are the kind of detailed answers people are looking for. And I suppose that'll maybe kind of tie into the next one. What's kind of been your favourite moment from the show, obviously, over those three seasons? And well, I suppose we can include the Millennium episode of The X-Files as well.
Well, before we do that, I'm curious, because we can get another answer later after you've watched them, but subconsciously, just in the back of your head, who's your favorite character? Do you remember any besides Frank? And
Frank's always the one that's kind of dominated it for me. When I think back to sort of Millennium and watching it, like, in and around that sort of period of time, my Twitter handle's Lee_Nostromo, so that kind of gives you an insight into I'm a fan of Alien. And when kind of Millennium came along, sort of at that kind of 10 age, you know, I'm watching, you know, movies like Aliens. You know, it's an 18 rated film, but I've got access to the VHS. You know, it's the type of film that you're watching with some of your friends. And you know, Lance Herneskin, to me, you know, and I still always think of him as Bishop from Aliens. So it was always quite exciting to know, like, this guy's great, and oh, you know, he was cut short in his prime in Alien 3. Spoilers if you've not seen that film over the many years. But I was so excited to have like a TV series where he is the lead character, and I've always been as a sort of sci-fi fan and a nerd and a geek, and in particular, especially with something like Star Trek, which was one of my favorite shows as a kid and probably still is, that when I saw like an actor that I liked in a franchise or series, I was always excited when I saw them pop up in something else or a movie. And the idea that Bishop had his own TV series where he was a lead and it was an X-Files spin-off made it all the more kind of exciting. So it was something like that I'm really excited for. It feels like one of you're rooting for one of your guys, and it's like, yeah, of course he's got his own TV series because he's the man, he's so good at that. And to have a show like that where it was so dark and interesting, it was a show that maybe just wasn't perfect at that time for like a kind of 10-year-old sort of in and around that kind of early age, where that kind of storytelling where it was just a bit too dark, a bit maybe too talky, just wasn't maybe sort of clicking with me at that age. But I was still excited to see this guy on a TV series sort of each and every week when I could get the chance.
Oh man, I hear you about the dark. I was probably a similar age to you when this came out, and the promos terrified me. I had no idea. I couldn't really comprehend what was going on in the promos because they were very jumpy. But I was, and as a fan of the X-Files at that age, I was like, okay, this is probably it's not meant for me.
Yeah, and I think it's like it's one of these ones, like I always think, like with shows at that age, you're, I think with something like The X-Files, you could kind of get into it like quite at that sort of young age. Like it was easy for me to watch it, and it was like a rip-roaring kind of, it felt like an action adventure, and you know, I was so big into UFOs and aliens, but sort of serial killers and that kind of religious imagery, whereas that could, you know, could come up from time to time in The X-Files. I think you have someone like Fox Mulder, which is, he's almost kind of got that boyish charm, and you're like, even at a young age, you think, oh, I could be a Fox Mulder. A Fox Mulder is very relatable. Perhaps that was just missing from someone like Frank Blank. You know, if you're a young guy, you don't really have an entryway into this TV series. You don't have that's my eyes, that's someone that I can relate to. Whereas kind of going through this sort of rewatch now as an adult, you know, you can sort of get into that cynicism and that kind of darkness much more easier. It's definitely very much more relatable, and kind of you can access it with a bit more cynicism about the world and how it all kind of unfolds and how human beings can treat each other with such horror. So kind of looking back on that, like, you know, all the what would be your favorite moment then from kind of the series?
And I hate to cheat here, it's tough. I'm gonna put out two, and then maybe by the time I'm done talking I'll pick one. The problem is, if I, you may want to close your eyes, because the first one is talking about something that happens later on. You might want to close your ears for a second.
No worries.
Okay, and that is the end, towards the end of Goodbye to All That. This shot of Jordan and Frank running out of the classroom with Mark Snow's, I think Drilling is the name of the piano piece, playing as they run out. And it's just done. It could, like a lot of times with the relationship between Jordan and Frank or Catherine and Frank, sometimes, you know, it didn't work perfectly, but there's moments like this where it could have so easily gone over into overly saccharine, overly sentimental, but I thought that is a wonderful image combined with the music, and it always really resonated with me. And it's actually one of the things, because where it happens in the show, it really kind of solidified the tone. I think it sums up the show really nicely. And similarly, and I'd hate to be cheesy and say that the other one that I think works really well is The End of Lamentation with Frank and Jordan going on the hike that he did earlier with Bletch up, I think it's up near Mount Baker. Can't think of another television show that would end such a dark episode with something so light but also somber and it not being over the top or sappy or something. It just, it's got a really great tone, and I think if you're in the right headspace, it can be a really a beautiful scene, and that's what really draws me to Millennium, is the positive aspects in the context of the negative. That's what I think really works well for it, is it's not a... I don't really think it's a cynical show in that essence. I think it's a critical show, especially season one, and it problematizes a lot of things in our culture, but I also think it has a lot of positive things to say about human nature and human relationships, so... There, I'll stop rambling. Gonna back up. Do you have any scenes that you remember that stuck with you from a child?
I always remember. I think it was it like, I could be wrong here, but was it not like around the end of season two or something like that, where there was like an apocalypse or something like
yeah.
that? Or I remember that. That was like the idea of like seeing an apocalypse on a television show, where, you know, apart from maybe something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer at that age, was something that kind of I think stuck in my mind. If that is definitely Millennium, man. So yeah, that like I think am I right with that one?
You want the spoilers? Is that okay?
Yeah, spoiler way. Like, you know, it's a Sunday afternoon. I've had a few drinks last night. Hey, if I remember this at the end, you know, and we've got a heat wave just now, I've done well.
Okay, perfect. Well, I'll try to keep it kind of vague, but that is one of the issues between season two and season three, is that for a lot of, and even when I showed the, let my friend borrow it, I actually didn't give him season three just as an experiment, because you don't, and he didn't, he's like, oh, that's the end of the show, that's it, because how can it end? I mean, so the fun thing about season two is the apocalypse, it's implied that much. Of course season three happens and there's a way they sort of come out of it, but it's a bold end, and if it would have ended there, wow. I, as somebody who likes a lot of season three, it's, I'm glad we have it, but boy, and that's where I kind of have to take a psychological reading of each season in order to kind of get around this. But yeah, that there's some fun stuff in that finale.
Excellent. Well, you know, with the rate these episodes will come out, you know, probably be next year before I get to it. But you know, we've had a lot of chat about what's to come. You know, or some of our favorite ones over the kind of the 3 years. But I suppose we'll pull it all the way back to 1996 with the episode that we're going to be discussing today. Then it's the fourth episode of the series called Judge. So for those not familiar with it, or those watching it for the first time along with us, here's a brief little synopsis of The Judge, so they'll give you some context of what we're going to talk about. So, Frank helps out Bob on a strange case. A woman receives a package containing a human tongue with no possible explanation of who sent it or why. Bob reveals that this is just one of a series of similar incidents, usually involving hands or fingers. And a little later, a body is found missing its tongue, and Frank soon matches it with another corpse belonging to the murderer. While Bob is willing to call this case closed, Frank believes that the truth goes deeper and there are more people involved, and Bob's skepticism evaporates when the gruesome packages start to arrive once again. So, this episode debuted on November 15th, 1996, and it earned a Nielsen rating of 7.6, meaning that roughly 7.6% of television-equipped households in America tuned in to that episode, which is kind of mind-boggling in these days. You know, people yeah. you know, get excited with a small share of 3%, so that's pretty exciting. And it got an IMDb rating of 7.8 out of 10 on IMDb, which was pretty consistent with the series as a whole, kind of in that one with kind of some episodes in around 7.4, maybe just some a little bit better, but they seem to kind of have a relatively high rating. For you yourself, Russell, can you remember when you watched this episode for the first time?
Oh, it would probably have been somewhere around 2004, 2003.
So yeah, kind of when obviously you saw it for that first time, what was your kind of and can you remember some of your first memories of watching this episode, you know, in those early days when probably you had less television and entertainment competing for your attention, when something like this is probably the high point of the week? What was it like for you when you first watched it?
Well, it was on a binge watch, so it was the first disc of Millennium and the first episodes I'd ever seen. So they were all on the first disc up to episodes 1 through 4, as you mentioned, that you did your binge watch on. So it was similar to mm-hmm. that. And I had a fairly positive reaction. It was neutral. Overall, I didn't really click. I didn't really start getting into Millennium until towards the end of season one, the first time. And I didn't really like it until I finished the entire thing. And that's when it kind of clicked. So at this point, I was kind of like, it's fine. But there were things about it, especially the performances, and we can get into that more, of some of the guest actors that I really liked. I was still kind of coming off of, the first time I watched Gehenna, coming off of the pilot. I wasn't sure. Things were very confusing and ambiguous. I wasn't sure where the show was going, what it was trying to do. And The Judge, for its credit, I think puts in a lot of ideas. It doesn't necessarily flesh any of them out, but I think that's fine. It's so early in the show that it created some actual tangible mystery, which is what I really appreciated from it. Even though it's not a perfect episode, and we'll talk about that, but I think it does, at its place in the season, it does some nice things.
Yeah, I think it is certainly quite an interesting episode in terms of sort of the concept. And I think with me, it kind of made me think when I started kind of watching it. You know, obviously, I think this is definitely the first time that I'd watched The Judge earlier this week. And I found it quite interesting in the respect that it got me kind of thinking about sort of its place in history as a kind of 90s TV series, much like kind of The X-Files was, and sort of how these shows really are kind of products of their time in terms of what they're looking at and exploring. And with something like this, that we're following serial killers largely over the series, and, you know, gone really are the days of television shows or movies exploring sort of serial killers. That, you know, you have something like 9/11 come along and it's all about kind of chasing terrorists. You know, we have kind of the writer for this episode, let me get his name here, Ted Mann. You know, Ted Mann was a non-X-Files writer, the first one to get involved with Millennium, and he would go on to write obviously things like Homeland. And, you know, almost for me, that I could almost see where his career went was sort of placed the show in sort of that time of the 90s where serial killers was quite a sexy concept. You know, we had things like Silence of the Lambs, you know, and then in sort of in and around the 90s we had things like the Unabomber and so many different kind of serial killers on kind of the go in terms of popular culture and the news and the period of the time. And so I find that quite interesting to watch this episode and think of that, much like The X-Files with exploring the UFOs and, footage and such like, and, you know, Bigfoot, and then sort of the digital age of the early 2000s come along and essentially kind of kills that as a popular culture phenomenon. So it's quite exciting to dive back into sort of the 90s and feel like this definitely is a product of its time and in a good way, I think.
Yeah, and one caveat I would add, this is just my own perspective, and I'd like to see what your thoughts are, especially as now and as time went on. One thing that's often levied against Millennium often is, repeating myself with the word often, is that it's a serial killer of the week, particularly in season one. And what I really liked about it, and what I think Carter is doing, is it's not so much serial killer of the week in the sense of, here's the gimmick, is that it's a concept particularly dealing with masculinity, and then we're going to explore that through a serial killer. So the concept is privileged over that, and so you have your modality and you have your stock characters and you have your conflict there, and a way to like manifest the negativity of that aspect in a way that's tangible and a narrative that we're familiar with. But that's one thing about shows that came later. Somebody tried to introduce me to Hannibal. And there's, I think, people say, oh, this is a lot like Millennium. And there's a lot going for it, but it doesn't have the socio-cultural, socio-political, and ethical undertones that Millennium does. And I'm not saying that's a problem, but that's one way I was able to kind of get around that. And I think that gives Millennium, it is at times very dated. And you're right, it is totally a part of its time and place, and that the serial killer has almost become mundane. I mean, it's what like all these Law and Order or shows like this, I guess, that do this kind of a thing now. And definitely, I don't have time to watch any of those, and the interest isn't there. And that has shifted to terrorism. It's a great observation, but that's something about it. I'm less concerned about the medium that it's coming through, the wrapper, the narrative wrapper, and more interested in what they're doing with it, considering the time especially.
I think they, like, there are definitely, with this episode in particular, I don't know if you've seen the 1990, the, obviously Hannibal, the book was adapted into a movie in the early 2000s by Ridley Scott, but when I watched this episode, the similarities almost between this and sort of Hannibal, and, you know, Hannibal Lecter as a character was quite sort of on the nose, but in terms of, like, this show was sort of leading the way, and actually I had to, you know, do a bit of Wikipedia research to go, which actually one of these came first, because such a memorable part of Hannibal, the movie and the book, was the use of pigs, like we see in this movie, this episode in particular, where they're used for essentially eating people and disposing of bodies and such like. And it was almost crazy to think, you know, like, this show definitely does have parallels with the Thomas Harris series, but this one was ahead of the game, and it was so spot on, the use of pigs, and then going, oh, it's good to see that that's going to come around in fashion again with another serial killer in 3 years' time.
Yeah, speaking of, I'm going to do some clicking here, because what I thought, okay, so it wasn't until much later, I think it was around 2007, there was a serial killer in Canada, in British Columbia, Robert Picton, and he was a pig farmer, and I believe he was also disposing of bodies in a similar way. So I thought, maybe this is something serial killers have done, and so they just picked it up and ran with it, and I didn't make the narrative connection that this is probably not common. I mean, not common, but something that a famous serial killer had done in the past, and so they mined it. But you may be totally right on that.
I always think of it, and if I remember this correctly, also from a British movie called Snatch, is that with pigs, that you have to remove the hair and the teeth, and then, like, a pig will, like, chew through, you know, the body like it's butter, really. You know, I always remembered something like that mentioned in Snatch, but that's why these pigs were so well used by sort of perhaps the mob and serial killers, for example, in this case. That's why the pig was the go-to animal of choice.
That's horrifying.
Yeah, exactly. You won't be able to look at a pig like that again in the future if you ever visit a zoo.
No, I do remember I went to a traditional village historical in Korea, and they had talked about, like, waste disposal, and, like, oh, that's probably did this in Rome too, but that they would process everything, and is a good way to keep sanitation in small towns. So I put everything, human waste, everything, and the pigs will eat everything and then process it. So good way to control disease. And but then I thought, okay, pigs, you're doing a lot of rough work. And I appreciate it on one hand, and I'm revolted.
Exactly. I feel bad for eating a sausage now and thinking, like, oh, that's what they've been up to. It's you know, if anyone's listening to this podcast over their breakfast, we can only apologize, but blame Chris Carter and his mad mind.
Ooh, yes.
So what we can do is we'll start to kind of talk about the plot. We'll kind of break up into, like, a couple of paragraphs, and we'll do a chunk at a time, and we can sort of share our thoughts sort of as we go through the episode and see where the conversation goes. But as with all Chris Carter shows, and Millennium is no different to the X-Files in this respect, we have a wonderful cold opening that really kind of grips you in. And so in a bowling alley, ex-convict Carl Nearman watches another man eat his meal before following outside, where he approaches him and kills him. Elsewhere, Annie Tisman receives a human tongue in a package. So if you've seen Seven, you know, when you see someone opening a box, you're already getting a bit of chills watching this kind of pack, this cold opening. But when you were watching this episode recently again, or back in the tape, what was your thoughts on this cold opening and what it kind of promises for the episode ahead?
There's one part, it's always kind of stuck with me, is when the person working for the judge, the initial person,
J.D. Bourne, I believe he is. I recognize him from Stargate, where he played an alien called a Tok'ra.
There we go. Got your expertise. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, this is the beauty of British Columbia. I should start learning more of these people's names. I know some of them, but, oh, good grief. The X-Files has given us a real, real burden. But he's sitting in the bowling alley, and he orders his food and the beer, and he's swigging it. The camera keeps doing close-ups to the victim, and who is eating ice cream or something, and with a fork, and it keeps zooming in and licking to get this, like, revolting, disgusting imagery, which makes you think that the person who's looking at him has this, which I think it kind of allows it to have some nice interpretation later, as if he had bought into the judge's programming and really had this loathing. But it gives you, it's sort of a red herring in that sense. But one thing about it was it reminds me quite a bit of a scene from Twin Peaks. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I have, yes.
Yeah, so the scene where Cooper confronts Jacques Renault in One-Eyed Jack's, and he's talking about the poker chip, and it zooms in on his mouth, and they're trying to play up this grotesquerie of a similar thing. It really, for some reason, always connects me to that, kind of takes me out of the scene, but it works. I mean, it makes you side with the, not side, but it makes you get a little bit into the head of that without being too over the top. It's not like some movies where they have the scene about people like spitting or having food roll out of the side of their mouth, but it's gross. And I thought hitting him with the bowling ball was a little campy and gimmicky and doesn't really make sense, but I guess he's improvising and drunk and maybe that's it. But as a cold open, before you know that, I thought it's a little more cartoonish than some of the other Millennium cold opens. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it almost reminded me with the bowling ball. It made me sort of think of a Tom and Jerry cartoon or something along those lines. It just felt like, oh, okay, of course it's a bowling alley. He's in a bowling alley. What else other prop could he have used and stuff? And I think with this, it almost makes me sort of think of somewhat of that kind of the 90s things. And maybe something that we sort of saw with something like HBO. And whereas with this show, it clearly is darker than The X-Files. Like, there's no bones about it. But it almost feels like they've just turned that up. And I think it's that part of a, you know, show discovering what it's going to be, what its tone is going to be. Many shows take seasons to do that, you know, countless episodes to do that. We're only 4 episodes in, and it feels like that sort of, not shock jock style, but kind of something trying to be a bit different, where it's like, you know, in The X-Files, you know, you would have got a bit of a mystery here, but with this, it's actually a human tongue, and it's not enough to, you know, tease that, oh my god, what could be in this box, that something like Seven, for example, that does so well. It's like, what could it be? And then you kind of you know, you open this box and it takes its time as she unwraps it, you know, it feels like past the parcel in a way. And then when it's opened, it's like, oh, it's a tongue, and you're looking at it and you think, oh wow, that really is, you know, late night television, you know, like seeing this torn out tongue right there in a box. And it feels maybe perhaps slightly undermined in terms of that kind of cold opening, for a way that we clearly can draw a parallel between the who's this tongue perhaps belongs to, but the sort of mystery is, why has this been posted in the mail? So it's one of these things that perhaps frustrates me a little bit with something like Millennium, in a way, is that we see these serial killers, you know, in particular this episode, we see how their plot's unraveling, what they're doing, why they're doing it. So what's kind of going on in the background with Frank is that he's almost one step behind us as an audience, which can perhaps be a bit frustrating. You're not as adverse in him uncovering things, as it were, because it's like, well, we're already a step ahead of it. And I always don't think that's perhaps always the best idea, and perhaps a mystery. I feel that we should be sort of running in parallel with our hero and our detective in this case.
I'm with you, and normally I prefer that wholeheartedly. And some episodes do that better, where they'll give you hints of what the other person is doing, but they don't show you too much. Case in point, Lamentation or Sacrament. And I think even like Powers, Principalities, things like that.
Yeah, but it's still, nonetheless, it's a pretty exciting one. And it definitely feels that it's kind of tied into that 90s culture of something like, even, you know, 25 years plus on, we're still talking about Seven. David Fincher, who for probably many is a master of the serial killer film, in terms of things like Seven, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So it is really tied into that popular culture of the 90s, which I thought was quite exciting. You know, when I saw someone opening a box, I thought, oh my god, is it going to be a head? You know, that was in my head. But with the tongue, it was like, no, that's slightly different. So kind of following on from the cold opening, the Millennium Group sends, obviously, Frank Black and pathologist Cheryl Andrews to investigate, as several people have received body parts in the post over the past few years, but no connection has been made between the recipients. No connection between the recipients has been found, nor have the body parts, nor where the body parts have come from. So, kind of with this story of sort of the body, the body horror aspect of we're seeing body parts kind of removed here. What was your thoughts on this? That like we clearly get the idea that something's going on. When you're watching this, why do you think they're perhaps taking the body parts? Are you expecting it to be part of something larger? What's your kind of feeling with this plot line? So when as you're watching it, what was your kind of thoughts on sort of this use of body horror and dissecting bodies and such like? What was your obviously we're kind of with Frank Black in this way that we're like, why is this? We don't know that aspect of this kind of mystery yet, but obviously that will come in time.
At this point in the series, body horror has already been ramped up so high that at this point it's pretty tame compared to the pilot, which is still, I think, horrifying, even in today's context. I mean, yes, of course, there's horror out there that I'm sure blows it out. But for television, the way that it connects it to human suffering as opposed to just spectacle. And here, I think, except for the individual who has his leg amputated and the implications that we get for that, it's just set dressing. It's grotesque, but it's not nearly as horrifying as I think even Dead Letters, I think, is more brutal in some of the stuff it does. In Gehenna, you find the ear in the garden, which is very, again, very David Lynch. There's a lot of homages to Fincher and Lynch and things throughout this. That, to me, just being incongruous. The tongue in the box, and this is something maybe I'm jumping ahead, that I think there is an issue with this episode editing. And it could also be in the script, but the editing is that when these discoveries are made, the scene lingers way too long. And you hinted at that earlier. The scene where they find the foot, why is there, like 30 seconds afterwards, where they have to have an actor act surprised and say, foot? And then people are talking. And they could just see the foot. Somebody could get shocked, cut to the next scene. When the body is found by the couple who are with the dog, they have to just linger there and say, I don't want to scare you, but there's a body over there. It's unnecessary, and it really cuts the tension down and the mystery. Kind of, I don't know, for me, how do you feel?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think sometimes it's an issue with perhaps 90s television where I think sometimes they forget that television is a visual thing where, yeah, we can see the bodies there. We don't need to have further explanation going, hey, there's a body there. And especially with us, like, we know that these things are unfolding. And as opposed to sort of having the shock of our heroes or, you know, people of interest out with discovering these things, we don't need it to be explained any further that oh my god, it's a foo. It seems a bit much, and it feels like there's the line when obviously they discover the foo, where it's like, oh, it's a foot. And then it's like the person almost, it makes me almost think of Die Hard going, we're not paid enough to handle this thing. And it's like, exactly. Oh, was that line really needed? Whereas the idea of just that visual of it going through the x-ray machine, and you're like, oh, that's pretty, yeah, that's what a foot might look like in one of these boxes. And it's just like someone maybe screaming, ah, it's a foot. Close, and then on to sort of the next scene. It's one of these things, perhaps for better or worse than 90s TV, that things sometimes didn't feel that they were ever in a rush, and it could just kind of go at a nice pace, where I think that's something that's naturally evolved with storytelling, is that it's got to be a bit more fast, it's a bit more on the go. And I think that's something that happened obviously with the X-Files as well, when you look at sort of the post 2000 reboot series, you know, it's a bit more fast, a bit more on the go, everything's a bit drived, where even sort of some of the biggest episodes of the X-Files, for example, when they came along, it told things at a pace that they were happy with, whereas now it's like Mulder's racing around in a car, he's got to get from one zone to the other. You know, you see where things like programs like 24, you know, HBO's storytelling has really kind of ramped up the television.
Totally true. I enjoy the slower pace at times, but sometimes if they just, it's got to be hard to fit a story in 40 minutes and get all the beats for commercial breaks. I sympathize with them. I really do. I just wanted to add that one of the reasons I selected this episode, one scene that has stuck with me more than any other, is the foot discovering scene. Because when I first watched it, the actor who yells foot, it's so awkward, and I would be driving my car some days, and I'll think, wow. And I finally just got to the point of thinking, is there any possible way any actor, could you get somebody like, let's get some Academy Award nominated actor and could pull that line off? I'm just not sure you could. And I felt very bad for the actor who, you know, tried their best and did their best, but it was so unnecessary, and the tone is so goofy. And it's it's not just the fact that it's giving us information we don't need. It's that we're taking this something that's really a grim. We don't need this kind of humor here. We're talking about someone whose leg was severed while they're alive, and the rest of the episode doesn't treat it trivially. And when you find out what happened to the person, that's not treated in a joking manner. Why are we doing this? Ethically, it's, and tonally, it's just a big mistake for the episode. It's something that hurts it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that could easily have been, like, put away with a line of dialogue going, well, we were just at the, you know, the local kind of mail sorting center has just picked up this foot in a box or something like that. And, you know, here we are now investigating, as opposed to having this side thing of a non-character really finding a foot, saying there's a foot, like, we need to alert someone that there's now a foot in the system. You can almost cut to that sort of extra thing. It's again, you don't need to show every single thing. And I think that kind of hurts this episode, is that we're always aware of things that are going on. Things just can't just be discovered and uncovered. You know, it sort of undermines the tension and excitement, perhaps, of the episode. You're almost just waiting for everything to kind of catch up with it. And, you know, we already know this kind of foot's going to be in there. And while it's a nice image seeing something like that come up on the X-ray, it just kind of like, you could have done something a bit better with that. It seems to be sort of an old television trope, for example. Yeah, so kind of then we're going back a small bit, we're introduced to Mike, and I'll have to do it in the voice of the judge, Bardale. And nice. He's a violent criminal who's recently been released from prison again, and he's approached by a man calling himself the titular character, the judge. And he offers Bardale a position in his court. And the judge is a vigilante hiring convicts to mete out his version of justice against those he perceives as criminals. And Bardale's first execution is that of the forebearer Newman. So what did you think of Mike Bardale? It's quite an exciting one for fans of cinema that we are introduced to John Hawkes. He's almost unrecognizable at first for me. It was only towards the end of the episode I was like, oh my god, that's John Hawkes. So what did you think of Mike Bardale and the introduction to the judge?
When I first watched this episode way back in 2003 or 4, I had no idea who he was. And I had seen Marshall Bell, who plays the judge, a few times. One of the reasons I liked this episode, and I still like this episode, is the guest performances by both of them, particularly John Hawkes towards the very end. The whole thing, I think he does well, but towards the end. The fact that you have a guest actor who gets such little running time, but puts so much depth into it, and then also he kind of has an arc in what is maybe 4 minutes of speaking time and is able to pull something off. It's fantastic. That type of character could be so boring, the Mike Bardale, but I think it works with what they invest in it. It pays off. What do you think?
Yeah, I really like it as well. It's such an interesting character as well. And I think the concept of a vigilante essentially recruiting in criminals and individuals to carry out his work is a really interesting idea, and it wasn't one that I'd sort of seen perhaps before in television or film. And yeah, I thought it was particularly quite exciting for that. And I think with someone like with John Hawkes and stuff, it adds a sort of prestige to the episode retrospectively. I mean, you know, you think of him, for example, he's been in three films that have been nominated for Best Picture, you know, Winter Bone, Lincoln, and just, you know, earlier this year, you know, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And you know, for me, I always think of him from things like, say, Congo, Eastbound and Down, you know, the Perfect Storm. He's one of these actors that he will have been in a television show, a movie, something that you love or particularly enjoy. And when you see him, you're like, oh, that's that guy from that thing. Mm-hmm. He's definitely one of those actors. And he brings in he's just got such a memorable, interesting face that I can see why someone like casting directors look to get him involved in so many different films. He's perfect for nearly every single role. And I don't think I've ever seen him in many kind of roles similar to this in his huge kind of career that he's had. You know, so it was really interesting to see him in this sort of heavily tattooed, you know, the longer hair. It was really quite exciting. Yeah, I think he's just such a great actor. And it's, you know, you think like this is what, 20 years ago, like how far he's come. You know, he is a fantastic actor, and I just wish he would get perhaps more leading role parts. You know, he's a great supporting actor, but you know, when he's given a lead role, I think he offers a lot. So then with obviously Mike Bardale, we're obviously introduced to the judge as well, and the judge describes sort of his plot and his concept. What did you kind of think of the judge? For me, I thought it was quite interesting that, you know, the judge is a title, you know, he is just motivated by kind of justice. That's his, you know, his MO, is excited about it. And I think it's a nice sort of, you know, trait that he has, that he's, you know, removing body parts and mailing them to victims. And it's a fascinating kind of thing. And it does tie in, as we say, to human bodies being sent in the mail. It's one of these things that's happened in the past before. It certainly makes for an interesting concept, the judge. And, you know, it's especially early doors, you can see why something like this is a strong choice. What was your take on the serial killer of the week in the form of the judge?
Well, I think thanks to Marshall Bell and some of the script choices at the end and the resolution, it's a fantastic character. It could have gone a lot of different directions. I like that it takes the vigilante angle and does something with it. I think if this was on its own, it might be a little bit more boring, but in the context of Millennium, already in the first four episodes with the pilot, we have these underlying motivators, and I don't mean to go back to this all well, but we have the contextual motivators driving each of the killers. So the pilot, it's sexual repression and a phobia. And then Gehenna, it's financial insecurity and other aspects of xenophobia. And then with the judge, I don't think it's simply a matter of justice. I think it's portrayed, Frank Blacklater puts it on the nose, that he's just playing a game. But it comes off instead that he is simply somebody who just wants to throw his weight around. And that's what's really nice about the ambiguity of, is there a supernatural aspect to it, or is this person just a very petty, semi-powerful, corrupt individual who has alienated everyone else in his life and is having to rely on these people to have some sort of influence in society in a way that he deems fit. And it's sort of how each of these extreme positions can take it to this far level of violence. And that's, for me, with especially Marshall Bell, the way he plays it, it could go either way. He's so cavalier, but he's also crude and he's also refined. It's the performance is what makes it for me, if any of that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think it's a kind of good counterbalance to someone like Frank as well, that, you know, that he is also a regular citizen, and, you know, they're going beyond sort of, with things like the kind of, with sort of the Millennium Sea Four, we see like the police that are restricted in terms of what they can do in this case. You know, we have it later in the line where it's like, I can't go near there or this will all happen, and, you know, you step on this man's property, you know, there's legal problems, where someone like Frank can go off and do it. He can look to administer justice, much like in a way that the judge does. He's looking to kind of go out with the regular order of you know, these people he views as criminals. He's looking to, you know, get justice on them, much in a way as Frank. And I wish that was maybe an element that was perhaps played up a little bit more in this episode, as opposed to kind of maybe focusing on some of those deadbeats that we talk about with, say, the scanner scene, where something like this, where we could see a bit more of the judge and Frank as a, you know, both sides of the same coin, perhaps, in a way.
That would be a great use of time. You're hitting at a point here. I was reading in an article Darren Mooney was writing, I was reading the other night about this episode on the movie blog. As always, I recommend everybody go read those. They're great.
Absolutely. What a genius that guy is.
Yeah. And he had some criticisms of it from the aspect about the private citizenship and how that's kind of a trope, and I think it's fair. But what I like about it and what I think really works, Frank walks in. He doesn't have a gun. He doesn't arrest anybody. He just walks on somebody's property and he talks, and that's it. And then everything gets resolved and walks off. And that is why, where I think the distinction between the two and what we're talking about with justice and why he's doing it, the judge in the first place. And it quickly takes you on the journey of, can you possibly side with this person's view at all of what the concept is? So I don't think it really needs to be explored too much unless they had a lot more time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of these things, perhaps with like, it was quite episodic television at the time, you know, serial killer of the week, really.
Yeah.
You know, if this was perhaps a modern day retelling of Millennium in this new millennium, maybe we would have seen little things like that played on more, or something like The Judge, which is such a great concept. You know, with a show like Millennium, yeah, it did go 3 years, but it could easily have gone 7. It could have maybe gone as long as, you know, The X-Files, who knows? But, you know, like, sometimes these shows are in such a rush to do an episode, to have a concept and go on to the next one, that sometimes a really good idea and concept, such as The Judge and all the imagery that goes along with that and where that could go, the investigation, is all wrapped up in a nice, neat little bundle in 45 minutes, and then we're on to the next serial killer kicking around in America and Canada and such like. It can be a bit frustrating, whereas I think, you know, that's just television that has changed. You know, that level of depth sometimes that we see our characters go into, it can sometimes just be surface level in episodic television, because you don't get that payoff when it goes out into syndication and you miss one episode, you don't have the backstory that what's Frank up to today, and who's this judge guy? I never saw the last episode. So, you know, it's a prisoner perhaps of its time, but it's still something there that we can discuss all these years later and pull from, and obviously someone like Darren's done that as well. So there's definitely lots of it to discuss. It's, you know, it's just obviously in the episode they just don't have the time commitment.
That's actually one thing I like about Millennium, is the fact that they have that sort of restriction, because a lot of modern television, they might sink an entire season into this single person or maybe two characters and kind of drag it out, and then the plot will turn into a soap opera about the characters and whatever else, as opposed to, or it'll be very routine. And here they're kind of able to get in, get some ideas, and they revisit it. But it's not on the nose, and that's what's wonderful, is that they're planting the seeds. This is one of the criticisms Darren Mooney had, and it's totally valid, is that this introduces a lot of things, and it's sloppy, and it's messy, and there's not really a lot of time to work with anything. Not to play devil's advocate, but that's what I really like about it. This is episode 4. Again, his criticism's totally legit, and I get where he's coming from, but personally, I like that it throws now a little more to the forefront the possibilities of where this narrative can go. Is there a supernatural aspect? Frank, how is he relating to these other people? Is there something else going on, or are these things all kind of crazy? And we're introduced to the idea of Legion at this point. This same plot and playing with Frank is revisited again in Lamentation, and then again with another character in Powers, Principalities right afterwards. And we're getting this continuity that's implied, but it's never really shown for sure that the judge and these other characters may be the same person. They may be totally unrelated, or there may be a thematic link, or there may be another supernatural link. We don't know. And the fact that there is this ambiguity gives us something to talk about, you know, 20 years later.
Absolutely, and that's sometimes the joy of this. You know, people might wonder, well, with so much television and, you know, cultural event, you know, why do people need to go back and revisit, you know, old TV series and stuff like that? Whereas, like, you know, we've both seen this episode one time, perhaps back in the day or not at all, and like, here we are 20 years later, there's still things to mine there, and, you know, exciting conversations to be had. And I think that's something that's going to be definitely a theme on this podcast series. But kind of going back to the episode, and yeah, as kind of touched on, the body of the man killed outside the bowling alley is discovered with the missing tongue, and it's identified as a retired police officer, Detective Mellon, who had given false testimony that had sent Annie Tisman's late husband to prison. Black realizes that the killer is motivated by the need to sort right from wrong, such as this, and killing those who have gotten away with crimes. Meanwhile, the judge passes sentence on another victim, a slumlord whose negligence caused a tenant's death, and Bardale is ordered to cut the landlord's leg off while he's still alive, and the leg is later found in the postal depot in packaging. So yeah, it's coming together now, and the idea that, you know, with serial killers, for example, that you know, someone like the judge, what he's carrying out there, you know, it probably does elicit some degree of sympathy from the audience. You know, how often, even nowadays, and is that we feel justice isn't properly done, that people that are held account, that aren't held accountable for crimes, and, you know, police, especially in things like America, it seems to be just constant in terms of the news that, you know, police officers committed this crime, or a murder's happened, or, yeah, you know, yeah, something's happened, and the justice doesn't envelop. And it's like, where something like this, it's such a relatable thing that, you know, how many times people thought in their head, you know, if I could get justice on that person. And that's quite the fascinating thing about the judge, is that he's made himself judge, jury, and executioner, and the reason that he's got these people murdered are things you can maybe think, I can maybe understand that. You know, I could see why someone would be pushed to make this type of decision. And, you know, it maybe doesn't go down the usual things that maybe sort of it was really pushing it to be something really dark, and to get us completely on the side of the, you know, the judge in this case, is like, you know, child abuse or rape and something like that. They kind of do keep it relatively PG in terms of what crimes have taken place here, which is good. It could easily have gone wildly into the other direction, I think.
That's a good point. I've never really considered that, because later in the series, or in this season, there's some stuff that goes... It's already gone really dark with the pilot, but I mean, it gets pretty intense, and that is good that they don't exploit it too much. And that was one of the issues I had with Seven when it came out. Besides being, I mean, the direction's fantastic, but besides being a little or quite a bit over the top and just the gore and the gruesomeness, it's hard to be sympathetic at all when it comes to, like, oh, the punishment fits the crime. It's too cartoonish, it's too grotesque, and it's too cruel. And here, it's horrifying, but in this crazy mindset of, like, corporal punishment that the judge has, it's a good point you make that it is a little more believable that somebody could, especially when you're working with convicts, find this degree of, like, you know, going to chop your hand off if you steal, or this old concept we have of frontier justice and things like this, at least in the U.S. I think the discussion, like you're talking about, of justice is not going away anytime soon, and it's something worth exploring in the legal sense. And that's what's fun later, is that he flaunts justice through the law in a way that you can with money and power, in order to employ his own sort of justice in a brutal outside the law way.
And I think with like the Millennium Group as well, we're still getting used to how it works within sort of justice and its own brand, really. And it's quite fascinating in these early days to work out what is the Millennium Group as such, and how does it work in, you know, with this world building that, you know, the Millennium Group are doing things, you know, out with what the law are doing, and how does that kind of relationship work, where it's like, right, call up these guys, and it's almost accepted that these people are a normal part of society, and, you know, they can be on the speed dial of local police, whether they're in Seattle or Washington or wherever. It's quite fascinating to see that, and it's going to be one of those ones that's going to be quite interesting with the rewatch and following along, is how that Millennium Group expands and grows, and how it, you know, how is it that it works so well in perhaps this real world, and what kind of cases it gets involved in. Because sometimes it reminds me of something you see sometimes in kind of the tropes of some British, you know, movies about crime and such, like, where it's like, you know, the local police can never figure it out, but hey, well, we won't bother really trying. Just call those other guys and get them in each and every single week. And I think that's quite an interesting aspect for me, is the Millennium Group and where it's going to go.
The mystery of who they are is one of the big mysteries of the show, and what they're doing, and how I think it gets around that trope that you're talking about, which is a legit concern, is that it's through Frank. I mean, Frank working there, and Frank is friends with Bletch, and so Bletch is reaching out to Frank as a friend for help on these specific cases, and then Frank is connecting with the Millennium Group. So they're not directly just helping any group or any cop anywhere. It's a limited resource, and they're like the Academy Group that it's based off of in the real world. And so for me, I think it kind of works, and that is how we are introduced to the cases, through Frank, and then he's the connection between the two. But on that note, that's one issue I had at the beginning of the episode from rewatching it. I hadn't remembered all the details, but often that trope will happen where the cops are completely incompetent. They don't know what's going on, and Frank comes in and hears this thing. And that actually, quite a few times in the episode, Bletch is able to do some decent work and kind of come off so there isn't this extreme dependence on the Millennium Group that there might be or there could be. I think the episode, as it goes on, I think does a fair job of redeeming that.
Yeah, and I think it's one of these ones we're so used to these perhaps things and sort of things, especially like the X-Files, that, you know, the outside groups, you know, having some involvement. And I think it's quite good to see these, you know, in particularly with the X-Files, we always associate anyone out with Mulder and Scully, whether it's within the FBI or the government, larger scale, you know, all the different groups, Cigarette Smoking, everyone's out to get them. But these characters, so it's quite nice with Millennium that it's almost a nice turn on that we see this outside group, but they're there to help, they're there to support justice and help that with that kind of unfolding, and they're not at this stage anyway undermining, you know, work to be done. They're there to help and support, which is a nice change perhaps.
Exactly. And I think the mundanity of it, if that's the proper pronunciation, I'm still waking up. The fact that they're here to help, yes, it's ambiguous and the show is trying to make it. You're curious about what it is compared to where it goes in later seasons. What I like about the tone here is that it is kind of a unique concept to have these people who are benevolent. There's nothing really weird going on that we can prove. There's just ambiguity. We're not sure. But it's, for some reason, it's just that right amount of mystery without it having to be where it ends up going. But we'll save that for season two talk.
Absolutely. So kind of in our final stretch of the episode, forensic evidence on the package eventually leads to Bardale and then to the judge. And the judge is arrested for questioning. And knowing that there's not enough evidence to warrant sentencing him, he offers Black a job with him, and Black refuses. But the judge is released. And Bardale is incensed that the judge has manipulated the law to his own ends and passes sentence on him for hypocrisy. Finding Bardale alone in a farmhouse, Black discovers that the convict has in fact fed the judge to his pigs. Cue the end of the episode. So, quite an interesting way to end the episode there. The master, the apprentice slays the master in a way here. What was your thoughts on how this episode kind of wrapped up nicely and neatly for episode 4?
I loved it. If everything worked at the same level as the ending, this would probably get a 9 from me as a rating. I think the way the judge is built up, the confrontation between him and Frank is done fantastically. Marshall Bell knocks it out of the park. We later get the tension kind of built up. Frank walks over, finds the envelope. It's that right amount of ambiguity. Is there something supernatural or was somebody watching? We don't know, and it's not really dwelt on. It's just kind of there, but implies he's still alive. Goes in, talks to Bardale. We get a fantastic performance, especially just physically, from John Hawks. That whole atmosphere there in the kitchen, pouring the beer or whatever over him, and that entire scene is fantastic. But the way that wraps up, like you're talking about, the subversion of the power of the judge by this convict, and the fact that he has his own rationale for it. It's not like, oh, he pushed me too far. It just kind of sums up the character really well. Like, this guy is BSing me. I'm not going to take this, whatever else. And it's done deftly, to use that word. I think it's fantastic. What about you?
Yeah, I think it's such a great ending to the episode. And I think that the problem is, like, for those who wield the law and power unruly, you know, they are in a position where there's always someone that's going to come round and look to do the same to them, that, you know, these people are not protected by any sense of moral or social code. As much as they claim that they want to see justice, they are operating outside of it. So they put themselves at huge risk, and I think that's a really good payoff. And I really enjoyed the scene with the judge and Black, and, you know, when he's, you know, opening the bidding, I'll put it at this, I'll put it at that. I found it, like, so interesting, and I was almost felt frustrated. I was like, I just wanted more of this character and this more of the relationship between the judge and Black. I thought it was quite a great moment there, and I just think, you know, it's such a memorable ending as well, you know, that the judge's body there surrounded by the mud and the pigs that are just oinking away. It's such a creepy ending that sticks with you, you know, whether you watched it all the way back in 96 or present day. It's certainly an ending that's unlike many others, you know, even though there's things like Hannibal, this sticks out, you know, it did it first and put it there on the TV. So yeah, a fantastic ending to an episode. While not the most perhaps greatest in the world, certainly has provoked a lot of interesting discussion. I like the ending a lot. It's a strong way to go out.
I wonder, we'll have to put this out to the listeners, and there's some people out there who are hardcore, historians of Millennium, and especially the Back to Frank Black people might have, or the Millennium people may know this, but I'm wondering if the confrontation and the performance between the judge and Frank, because that's mirrored on and that character's kind of continued in that style of scene, that the sort of temptation of Frank Black occurs a few more times, and I wonder when that decision was made, if it was Carter's decision or what. But again, it could just, that goes why Frank Black is so great, just downplays, and Henriksen is phenomenal, he downplays all of this and the way that the script for him, he does it. That scene sums up one of the reasons I love Millennium, and I love Henriksen's performance.
Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of ties back into the comparison between the Judge and Black, is that, you know, Black simply refuses. You know, he has his own strict moral code to follow and his view of justice and how it should unfold. And, you know, that much like the Judge, and it's like the fact that, you know, yeah, there could be temptation there, but it's the fact that he is true to his word. And it's having that early doors makes it very clear this is who this character is. This is the code that defines him. And it makes it interesting for writers to go forward, is that it's something that they can pull back to, you know, that, yeah, there might be someone similar out there, you know, a darker side to someone like a Frank Black. But this is his code. This is how he's going to work. And this will be the template going forward. You know, nothing will tempt him if something like this certainly won't.
That's a great point, and that is what I really like, again, playing off of when the Judge tempts him with, he can protect his family. It's on the nose, but it's not too much when you're watching it to realize Frank Black is not really interested in justice. He's interested in preventing harm. He's interested in protecting people in that abstract, in his family and everything else. It's not like, oh, I want to get that killer in jail because that's what they deserve. No, Frank Black is motivated in, I want to get that killer in jail so no one else is killed. And that's the operation that he's going on. So it's that even further extreme from the, let's just inflict violence for something else. And that's what makes him another great character, is he's so assertive in his, non-violence or passivity. I mean, there are times when he does have violence, but that's where it's necessitated by the character and not just forced in for the narrative to create conflict. And that, again, is why that wonderful confrontation between him and John Hawks at the end works so well. So many other shows would play that completely different. But to have the major confrontation happen with this complete, calm, detached discussion and find out everything happened off screen, and yet it's satisfying. That's pretty nice. I got to give Mann credit for coming up with that.
Absolutely. And I think it works quite, it shows you something like Frank Black. Like, for us, we're like, oh my god, this guy's carrying out justice, you know, chopping up body parts. You almost get the impression for Black, it's like, yeah, just another day at the office. And, yes, you know, yeah, why would I get emotional about this? You know, I deal with this sort of nonsense all the time. He's immune to something like that. And I think that for what I imagine will come, you know, to come in the series, you know, certainly things will shock and, you know, surprise him. You can't do that every single episode where it's like, oh, this week serial killer and it's got his own unique twist on it. You know, it would undermine him as being someone that's professional and knows all about how this unfolds. And I think that's an exciting aspect of the character, and it kind of lends into that he's got this past, that it could be, you know, things that we can pull from that in the future, that what were the things that shocked him in the past, what led him to this level of calm and security, because that comes from professional experience and life, you know, as well. So it's going to be interesting to rewatch and discover Frank Black of what's to come and what's past.
You're going to have fun, I hope. Be patient.
Absolutely.
It's up and down, but when it's up, hooray. If I could jump in and have a question for you and make a complaint, and then a wish, and then a question for you, if that's okay.
Yeah, fire away.
All right. One of my favorite actors in Millennium, and pretty much anything she does, CCH Pounder, one of the Millennium Group people, Cheryl Andrews. I think this is her first episode she shows up in. And it's something I will agree with Darren completely on the movie blog, is wasted. Mm-hmm. She is fantastic. Waste is not the right term, because she's still awesome and, you know, elevates those scenes that a normal actor would just be like, eh. But what potential? I mean, come back a few times, but in the show, definitely not utilized enough. I'm shocked watching this, or when you watch something like Dwayne Barry and the X-Files, mm-hmm. that people have not cast her in like a strong leading role, like a Frank Black, to have a show where she can lead in a character like that. I think if Millennium or a Millennium-ish show came out, I would love to see her cast in the lead.
Yeah, and she's one of those people that you kind of look through her career, and she has been always that supporting actor, you know, and in and around different things. And, you know, I know she seems to be a series regular in something like NCIS New Orleans, but I can't claim to have ever watched a single episode of that. But, you know, such a great actor, you know, she evokes so many kind of, you know, the fact that she's going to be more prominent in the series excites me, and I'm looking forward to watching that unfold.
Yeah, I just wish, she's a great character actor, but they're always typecast as like the hard-nosed cop, kind of a supervisor. But to be able to give her a role that can soften get a little more range, it would be fantastic, because she just has got so much presence in this and X-Files and everything else. It would be fantastic. But I will table that and look forward to seeing what you think as her character progresses.
Absolutely. I look forward to getting involved in, no doubt, the Facebook comment sections of these episodes. They all unfold. And kind of for yourself, Russell, what's your kind of last sort of thoughts on this episode?
I'm not going to say it's a phenomenal episode, but it's a good example of the potential of Season 1 Millennium, of where it can go in riding the ambiguity, I think, in a nice way. There, it may lean overly supernatural, or maybe it's tough. I don't know. But compared to some other things, this is the Millennium tone I like from that aspect, especially the ending. The beginning is a little cartoonish, like we talked about with the bowling ball and the foot and something else. But the ending, the confrontation, all of that, the final 10 minutes, it's an excellent example early on in the series that says this is the potential the show can take. And I'm repeating myself. So let me turn it over to you, sir. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's quite an interesting episode. Obviously, I'm kind of four episodes into my rewatch, and we're sort of now settling into what could feel like a nice rhythm to the series ahead. And, you know, I'm really excited about this kind of episode. I mean, here we are, we're nearly an hour and 20 minutes into our discussion, you know, before it's all perhaps edited down. So you might only enjoy a 10-minute discussion of this episode. But I think for an episode that, you know, as we discussed, there's some interesting aspects to it. Some parts are a bit unremarkable, and maybe in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to be the most memorable one. But here we are, after all this time, still being able to have this exciting discussion about it, justice, what it could mean for Frank Black's going in the past, going forward, and sort of as that show's finding its rhythm and its routine. As I always find, season ones of programs, even shows that, you know, something like The Next Generation, for example, the Star Trek show, which had a notoriously poor first season for the most part, there's still things in there where you see the shape of things to come and things to get excited about. And this episode here has that, and I think it's going to be interesting to see as they continue to refine that over the season where it goes. And I think with knowing some of the troubled history that Millennium has of what will continue to stay on in the second season, the third season, and how it will continue to evolve, so I'm excited to kind of be here nice and early in the beginning of the journey. And I'm sure there'll be maybe one or two listeners that will be rewatching it for maybe the second time, or perhaps for the first time, you know, after the strength of loving something like The X-Files, now giving this a fair shake as well. So, yeah, I'm excited.
Well, based on that, what would you rate it out of 10?
Yeah, I'm not a 10 person myself, but okay. I'd go for something like, you know, I'd go for a 6 or something like that with this. I think it's a good piece of television. I enjoyed I've watched it twice now, and I enjoyed watching it kind of a second time. And I think the Judge is an exciting kind of character, and I think the use of Bardale, you know, you've essentially got two villains of the piece really here. I think it's quite an interesting concept, and yeah, I really liked it. And I think the Judge is a great character. I would have loved to see more between him and Black, and I think that's perhaps a failing of the episode, that we didn't maybe get that kind of, you know, pairing off between the two of them, and that we were always sort of one step ahead of Black was a bit frustrating. But overall, a pretty enjoyable episode, a good way to spend a Sunday morning. What about yourself, Russ?
I'm pretty close. I've been going back between 6.5 and 7. It's very uneven, like a lot of Millennium, but the highs are high, and the rest is, it's okay. Overall, I enjoy watching it. I think it's a great addition to the Millennium canon. But it's also not, if I was going to pull somebody up and say, oh, you got to check out Millennium, it's an okay episode. I mean, it wouldn't be the worst episode to introduce people to, but it's very dated in quite a few ways. But overall, I'm thankful it exists.
And kind of to kind of wrap up, like, Russell, if people wanted to have like a conversation further about this episode, or, you know, you're learn more about yourself, where could people maybe find you online or get in touch with you?
I'm generally in the Facebook group that Tony set up for this, and then also on Twitter, just RLHUGOW. And then I rarely post anything, but I often will read the discussions that happen. I mean, I'll sometimes join in on this, but I don't ever really just initiate tweets. I'm more of a lurker who works too much and doesn't get to enjoy life. And except
like
for
a
these,
true X-Files character, you're there in the background pulling strings and watching things unfold from a nice comfy chair.
Well, that's a very romantic interpretation of it. It's there's no comfy chair, and it's usually like a 5-minute coffee break, but I'll take what I can get. I appreciate that. How about you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, as I mentioned earlier, Lee_Nostromo. Yeah, I'm likewise in that same Facebook group. So, yeah, hopefully people aren't frustrated thinking, how dare you be on the show and not have watched it in a long time? But I hope people will enjoy the journey with me as well. And you can find me on my own podcast, Filibuster. I'm part of the Nerd Party Network, where we carry out interviews, we discuss pop culture and film and such like. So, yeah, you can find me on there. But, yeah, thank you very much for talking with me today, Russell. It's been a real pleasure. And thanks for Tony for asking us to get involved in this early part of the project. Hopefully people haven't been put off by us 4 episodes in, that they're still with the show, and it's been a real pleasure to get involved, and good luck to Tony and the gang for the season ahead.
Well, A, thanks for letting me join, and two, for you joining, your perspective. I mean, you're familiar with the X-Files, and it's going to be awesome to have it going along, so I hope you can come back on, and I'd love to see what you think about the ending to season 1 and 2. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed and give Tony, come on, get Lee back on here.
Yeah, I think I'm down for another episode in the future, so hopefully I'll be back again in the future. But, and to the same to the audience, you know, thanks for listening. I know there's so many podcasts out there, so thanks for listening, and remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook, if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.